Hello out there, thinkers, linkers, and mappers. We are really happy to host a series of conversations around the topic of tools for thinking. Our longer-term goal is to spark a diverse, connected, shared memory that will help us make important decisions together as humans. Our near-term goal with these podcasts is to blow more oxygen on the growing tools for thinking sector, addressing key issues and talking with the people who are doing the work. This podcast is created by BetaWorks, a New York City-based startup studio. I'm Jerry Mikulski, your interlocutor and obsessive mind mapper. Our topic today is maps and creativity. Our guests are Anne-Laure LeConf, the founder of Nest Labs, and Lorenzo Bernaschina, the founder of Gems Notes. And we have a juicy, wonderful topic in front of us. I would love if you could maybe introduce yourselves, sort of your relation to the topic, and then we'll head on in. Anne-Laure, if you would go first, that'd be great.
Yes, sure. Thanks for having us. So as you said, I'm the founder of Nest Labs, and on our website, we've published, I think now more than 50 interviews with founders and creators of tools for thought. So I haven't built my own like Lorenzo did, but I know a little bit about them. And some of the ones I like the most and I find the most powerful are the kinds of tools that allow you to easily connect your ideas in a visual way. So that's why I really like this topic, and I'm super excited to talk about it more today.
Love that. Thank you. Lorenzo.
Yeah, thank you for having me as well. And I'm Lorenzo. I'm the founder of Gems, which is a self-organizing whiteboard to cluster and connect ideas with the help of artificial intelligence. And it's actually interesting because I think that the work of Anne-Laure and Nest Labs really influenced this since the very beginning. So it's exciting to be here and discussing about this together today.
I love that. Lorenzo, can you just pick up on that, what you just said, and talk about the influence and how you thought about what you're creating, and just bring us into what Gems Notes is doing?
Sure. I think the trigger was during the pandemic. So I was working as a software engineer, and I was doing a master in machine learning and artificial intelligence. And I had to pick the topic for the thesis in the middle of the pandemic. And of course I thought about something helpful in that context, right? And so I built that thing to basically help researchers find meaningful information. There was a lot of research and stuff. We didn't really know anything about the disease at the time. So we were really like in a rush to really understand what was going on with the disease. And there were a lot of papers and knowledge shared every day. And so there was clearly a problem to figure out, you know, like what's going on here? What are the relevant information to really move our understanding forward? And so I built a tool in that space. And at the time I realized there was so much noise, right? It was hard to actually get to the insights, to the gems. That's where the name of the tool comes from. And so that was the kind of trigger for me. And I remember at the time there was this course that Anne-Laure did about collectors to creators. Really sounded interesting because, you know, it was this concept of moving from this kind of like, yes, we have a lot of interesting stuff and things, but how can we actually make sense of them and do something with them, understand or create something? So that was the trigger. I got into the course, was amazing, met a bunch of interesting people. And that was the start, how I started thinking about this thing and interacting with people about the topic. Yeah.
Love that. And Laura, how did the pandemic affect what you were thinking about or doing in this space?
By the way, it's amazing that you took the course and that was one of your sources of inspiration. I didn't know that. So that's great. Which is also why it's funny that we crossed paths during that course, which was in 2020, because I started teaching online during the pandemic. Also because, so I had started a newsletter 6 months before the pandemic started, and it was very much a one-way type of broadcasting relationship that I had with my readers. Every week, I would just send someone something, they would read it, and that was basically it. I did have, at the end of my newsletter, a little note saying, please reply, hit reply, and say hello if you have anything that you want to share back with me. And in March 2020, all of a sudden, I got lots of replies, a lot more than I used to have before. And people were telling me how lonely they were feeling, how confused they were feeling, how overwhelmed they were with all of that contradictory information around them, with the fact that they didn't have any mechanism to keep on hanging out with colleagues, brainstorm ideas, figuring out things together, that it felt very lonely and isolated. And so this is why at the very beginning of the pandemic, I figured, okay, what if I try to shift from this one-way broadcasting relationship towards something where I become more of a facilitator, allowing people to connect together and learn from each other? How do I ensure that I'm not a barrier preventing them from growing? And I, you know, kind of like, yeah, create as, behave as a connector, basically. So I created the Nest Labs community, and I then decided to turn a lot of the articles that I wrote into an online course, which was called, as Lorenzo said, From Collector to Creator. Basically teaching people who were naturally curious already, who were collecting a lot of ideas, but not doing much with them, how to generate their own insights from data and information that they had gathered through their reading or listening to podcasts and all of these kind of things, and becoming creators themselves and starting contributing to the public discourse themselves.
Love that. Love also how sort of our paths all were changed and maybe intersected more at the start of pandemic, because coincident with the start of pandemic, I got into a couple of conversations, was introduced to a guy who runs a consultancy in Boston. We started talking, and that turned into us inviting our communities into a series of calls that we call Open Global Mind, which is now a community of practice and has a bunch of different standing calls every week, where two where geeks meet and one where the whole community sort of comes together. And also, there's been just this rich sharing of information and methods and what we're seeing and what we're doing, and it's lovely. So I don't know, sometimes there's silver linings to disasters, and if the pandemic has some silver linings, maybe it's that, including the pressure and the need to start identifying causes and solutions to the pandemic itself, like, you know, comparing different countries' policy responses to it and so forth. Let me take a step back for a second. And Laura, you wrote a post a while ago called Thinking in Maps from the Lascaux Caves to Knowledge Graphs, in which one of the things you said was that thinking in maps is really different from thinking in sentences. Can you sort of add some water to that thought from back when and bring it back into this conversation for us?
Yes, and it's kind of relevant to what you were saying about making sense of a crisis and all of that contradictory information. When we think in sentences, we tend to think in a linear way. We go from A and then to B and then to C, and we kind of think in the way that feels the most intuitive and logical in the moment, and that leads you very often to results that sound like common sense. The problem is that, and we've seen that during the pandemic, common sense doesn't mean that you're right. It's not, because a lot of people think the same thing and it feels like the most obvious answer that it is the correct answer. When you think in maps, you are not trying to get from A to B as quickly as possible, to get an answer as quickly as possible. You're basically building a playground for emergence. You're adding nodes, and you're not trying to find an answer by looking at the intrinsic qualities or the information in each nodes, but you're trying to look at how they work together, how they connect together, how they influence each other. And in this way, you can start seeing patterns that you may not be able to see if you're right, your nose just in front of that piece of information and not seeing it in context. You're not going to be able to get the same kind of answers as if you're looking at the whole map. So thinking in maps is slower in general, though I'm super curious to hear more about what Lorenzo is doing with AI, because one of the reasons why it's much slower at the moment is because as a human, you do have to go through all of these steps, doing all of the pattern recognition. It's not that easy to do, but you do get better ideas and better insights by doing this. So that's what thinking in map, and that's why it's different from thinking in sentences.
Thank you. Lorenzo, how do you connect to that? Yeah.
I think really, like, we have always like thought that, like, maps are a very powerful tools for thought, right? We have used them since forever. And so when we talk about this space, about tools for thought, I think it would be very interesting. I thought at the time when it started, it would be very interesting to find a way to augment them, right? And see how to actually increase our cognitive powers with them. And I think that AI is, you know, today is starting to getting powerful enough to support this kind of ambitious processes. And the challenge there is really come up with an interface that helps, allows us to interact with it in a meaningful way. And Maps sounds to be very, very interesting as a, as a, as an interface to do that. Because again, it's something that it's, we're used to, we use, but, you know, there are some challenges, as Anlor said, it's really like manual and it's hard. So definitely the goal here, I would say, is use AI to augment this process and help you find those relationships and clusters faster.
It's really interesting because one of the things I've made explicit and talked about as people ask me, like I map using the Brain software, which I was on their first press tour 25 years ago. In another couple of weeks, it'll be December and it'll actually be a quarter century that I've been feeding one mind map. Wow. And one of my observations from doing so is that whenever I add something to this map, which I do probably 50 times a day, it throws me into system two thinking from Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, where usually, and I have this feeling that when we're busy retweeting things that we see in the tweet stream or a light gesture of, yeah, this is cool, I should forward this to my people, is system one. It's very reflexive sort of thinking. But very explicitly, when I put something in my brain, is it worth remembering? Yes. Where do I put it? What is it similar to? Like, what do I hang it on? Because I don't just drop things in this space. It's like hanging ornaments on a Christmas tree. I'm always building context, right? So where does it go? What should I call it? What else is it connected to? What more can I learn? Right? And I do that loop really quickly, 50 times a day, just to sort of to feed the brain. But then there's a different thing that's going on, which is the visual context side of it, which is different from system one, system two thinking. There's something else that happens when you start to see evidence near each other. It's a little bit, it's the reason why when we do crime movies, we have murder boards where they put like pictures of all the suspects up and you have pins in them with like yarn connecting them and all that. And I only learned recently that those are called murder boards, which is kind of a little eerie, but cool. But there's something else that happens with the visual thinking. And then Lorenzo, I'm really interested in understanding better. There's something else happens now when you bring machine learning and other kinds of intelligence into that context, into that setting. And there's lots of different things that AI ML could be doing. Where are you starting? And how does it sort of help in the mapping?
Yeah. So first of all, I have some couple of those kind of users that use it as a murder board, which is kind of interesting. And yeah, I think I'm really focusing for now on spotting relationships faster. That was the main focus. And seeing how things come together by clustering them by topic. So right now, these are my two main focuses. I think, of course, in the future, the idea is to add, many different filters to help you look at the knowledge and how the thing comes together from many different angles. But right now, I would say the primary focuses are on connections and grouping stuff. Because ultimately, you know, when it comes to creativity, combinatorial creativity, you basically make comparisons, associations. You want to see how the things come together. What are the relationships, the similarities, what's different, and make those sort of comparisons. So that's pretty like the basic thing, the first thing you normally do with maps, right? And then, of course, on top of it, you can build a bunch of other things and think about more creative ways. But that was the kind of basic that I'm covering right now.
And Laura, like, what do you wish you could do with these tools, or what are you doing with these sorts of tools now? Where does this take you?
I think something that I've really enjoyed in the past couple of years is how I personally use Roam, which is not as visual, but something that I've really enjoyed, which is similar to the way you're using the brain yourself, is that I used to have different tools for different pieces of information, which I'm sure was hindering my creativity, because all of these different ideas, these different nodes, were living in silos and in different environments where I could not connect them together. And right now, I think that my kind of thinking playground looks very messy from the outside, because there's everything, my personal stuff is in there, my professional stuff is in there. I have tasks that I want to work on, but I have ideas that I want to think about as well. I have things that are very practical, very conceptual. I have notes about people that I hang out with. I have all of these things together in one place. And though the tool I'm using right now is not really good when it comes to a visual map, there is still all of this underlying network between those ideas. Those are still nodes that I can connect at a very granular level. And it's made it so much easier for me to, you know, I write a newsletter, I'm doing a PhD, I'm doing 1,000 different things. And it's become a lot easier to cross-pollinate ideas in between different projects and different areas of my life, which before were living in complete isolation. So this is something that I'm very excited about. The kind of counterpoint of this, and which is why I am excited about the advances that we're going to start seeing with AI and machine learning, is that there's so much in there that I know they are, as Lorenzo, very good branding, by the way, there are some gems in there that are very hard for me to find at the moment. And it happens sometimes that I stumble upon a connection or a node or something really interesting, maybe a month after I've submitted an article. And I'm like, oh, if only I had seen that at the time, that would have absolutely gone into the manuscript. But it didn't, because I didn't find it. So it's still not perfect, but I'm very excited about the potential.
So I want to pick up one word you said just a moment ago, which was manuscript. And I haven't published a book, but I've been close and had several books in my sort of brain. And one of the things I want to put in the intro to the book is, hey, thank you for buying this souvenir. This is a slice in time. This is a snapshot of a bunch of thinking in time that's been forced into a linear order, because that's what books do. The artifact is available openly on the web, fully updated, and is much more interesting and useful. And by buying the book, you can now mark it up and you can do whatever else. But come join us, because these gems are basically threaded together into an Indra's net of context, where, in fact, you can find conversations about the different gems, right? So maybe in your dissertation, there's a piece about how people process mapping information in their visual cortex. I'm making this up. But you could go talk to people doing the visual cortex research, because there's an online community or a Discord server or whatever else where those people are. And if you could get permission to join the conversation, you're suddenly there. Long way of explaining that. For me, like, the notion that we still have in our heads that we publish something and then your book is this dry, static thing that you can't go back and update, is, it makes me sad. And I'm really interested in this connected world, where connected visual world, where we can continue the conversation and improve, you know, buff the gems and connect the gems and keep doing this over and over again together as a society. And we don't, I think we don't have that experience. We don't have that experience for sure, or at least most of us don't, but we don't even have that dream very often, which is interesting to me.
I definitely have this frustration when I read either paper books or even digital books or even pages on the internet that I cannot see where they are on the map. So I cannot see, I discovered a couple of years ago, which is amazing, that Wikipedia actually has backlinks on each page. You can see the pages that link back to the visual Wikipedia. But it's very interesting that it's not a prominent feature. You have to know it's there and you have to dig for it. But that's amazing, because it does help you see, again, it's not a visual map, but still kind of see where this page is on the map by seeing all of the other pages that are talking about this page, right? And I think it would be so interesting if in books and on web pages everywhere, you could see where that page is on the map, who's talking about it, what conversations are happening. And as you said, if you could join those conversations, learn more, maybe contribute yourself. So yes, that would be the dream. That would probably require to change the architecture of the whole way we're publishing content at the moment, but that would be the dream.
If you think about it from the book publisher's perspective, yes, it's dramatic changes, et cetera. If you think about it from the perspective of the companies we're busy talking to every day, and how this sector of tools for thinking is sort of expanding and growing, and what people are doing like Lorenzo, it gets a lot closer really quickly. Lorenzo, I think you wanted to jump in on the same topic.
I was just asking, I was curious about the dream you mentioned, that some people don't have the dream. So I was just curious about if you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, and I realized as I was saying that I was kind of speaking for everybody, and that's a dangerous thing to try to do. But I'm in a lot of conversations where I'm trying to figure out what does the future of media look like. And one of the tropes I say is, in the early days of movie making, we put a new camera, which you had to turn by hand, on a tripod in front of a stage where they performed theater, because everybody understood theater from way back when. And then somebody said, hey, what if we put this tripod on a dolly and move it around, and suddenly you get the panning shot? And then you get jump cuts, because when they were editing the film, they were like, we could lose some of this footage and we could move it over here. And then we got, you know, Eisenstein gives us the montage and a bunch of other, and suddenly we have the language of cinema, which with modern tools has gone kind of, you know, wacko. It's really interesting to see what's possible with visual arts. Awesome. The web, our experience of the web and the intertubes and apps and all that seems to be frozen in an early media model where we have radio. We're recording a podcast right now, which is both a TV show and a radio show, right? We're doing both. We're sending out the audio and the video. We have books and magazines and little blurbs, which are called blog posts or, you know, newspapers or whatever. And we have a couple other sort of artifacts. We really haven't moved beyond our traditional physically limited ideas of what media is. And worse, intellectual property over protection has kind of limited us from the real connectedness of ideas, right? And so I think that in conversations, I find that when I start exploring that space of what could be next, where could we go, there aren't enough of us who have said, oh yeah, Here's a vision of what that could look like. And we're sort of still bouncing off of Ted Nelson's vision of, you know, Project Xanadu. And small funny aside, one of the first interviews I ever did as a tech industry trends analyst was with Roger Gregory, the head of the Xanadu company in Menlo Park, I think, at the time. And I wrote, let's call it 1991, I wrote an article about Xanadu, and I said, I sort of listened to them, and they were like, 2 years from now, we're going to have a platform available. Imagine my surprise in 2010, to read an article about Project Xanadu, in which one of the lines in there said, they're going to have a product in the market in 2 years. So I've been watching this for a long time, and even the visionaries have had a hard time getting to market. And that's why I'm so excited about what's happening right now. So that's, I don't know if that helps, Lorenzo, but It feels like we run into mental barriers somehow. And it also feels like the tech industry works in a step function where suddenly there's a breakthrough and it's like, oh my God, somebody invented HTML and the domain name system and a couple other things. And then you see the web show up and go crazy. And then you see the web get co-opted. And then you see, you know, layers of things happen. And I think we're at this creative cusp right now where new things are happening that you and others are busy building.
That's really interesting. And I think that, you know, I think that most of the tools we have in the Tools for Thought space really have shared these sort of common design principles from a past where really many of the technologies available today, like AI, was not so available and powerful, right? So I really think part of the thing here is really, you know, how these interfaces are going to change to really enable and unlock the potential of these technologies. So it's very interesting. Yeah.
How does that frontier look to you? Like, what are the things you hope and expect to be able to fold in over the next couple of years, not just sort of, you know, the near term?
Well, I think I see really spatial canvases in general, not because I'm working on it, but in general, this is a pretty common direction that is explored right now, along with probably dialogues with the large language model. So these two routes are definitely two very interesting paths that people are exploring in terms of how do we actually operate and collaborate more efficiently with the AI. Yeah, I will say these two are my two big bets right now.
Thanks. And Laura, what do you see that you're looking forward to?
Very excited to see more people be creative, because I think that everyone is able to be creative and to produce creative work, but that I can understand why for lots of people it's been intimidating to start jumping into this as an adult if you haven't maybe found that passion when you were a kid, if you haven't gotten the training that you wanted to get as a kid, if you were not one of those teenagers who downloaded like a cracked version of Photoshop when they were 13 and started playing with it at that age, and then you're a little bit older and you want to learn, but also you have a day job, you have kids. So a lot of people, I think, have this feeling that they could do creative work, but feel a little bit intimidated because they don't feel like they have the right technical skills to do it. And what I'm seeing right now with a lot of the new tools is that it's removing this artificial barrier between people who have the pure technical know-how and people who don't. So you basically have more space to express pure human creativity without really having to worry about the fact that, oh, do I know how to use this tool? Do I have this technical skill, etc.? So I'm very curious to see all of the kind of creative work that's going to be produced by people who currently didn't have access to that space.
I love that. And our call is titled Maps and Creativity. And it opens a whole lot of really lovely questions like, how does mapping affect our creativity? I've been to, and I think you've probably been to, and many people listening have probably been to events where there's a graphic facilitator or a graphic recorder who's writing on the wall on large sheets of paper and who's busy channeling what they hear happening in the conversation, capturing just a few words and phrases to trigger those ideas, and then listening for metaphors. And, oh, there's a bridge here. There's a stop sign and a bridge. Okay, good. So they'll draw a bridge. Or there's some biological organism, so they'll draw a bacterium or whatever. What I love is when on day two of that event, somebody points to the wall, to the place where there was a drawing yesterday that was really captivating or that really caught the moment. It's like, okay, so there's space and visual and all of these things are now playing into a group conversation. And part of what I'm wondering is, how do these tools that we're busy talking about and building have the same effect on a group conversation in cyberspace or in the metaverse or in whatever we want to call this thing?
I think ultimately, like, the real power of these things is the non-linear thinking they enable, right? Which is basically, you know, it perfectly mirrors the actual way your brain works. And again, one of the problem I think at the design level of the tool we have in the tech space is that they come from a past and where we decided for some reason that the main interface was a page. And so everything happens in there and it's very linear, as Laura said before. And so I think that's part of the challenge and the problem we have here. So maps are really, like, to me, a good way to really unlock the brain powers and find, you know, and mirror the way our neurons and brains work. And if you could augment them with AI, that would be super great, right?
And I would add to this that something that you can do in a digital space that you cannot do with those kind of physical maps that you have at events, which I love also. I think they're amazing conversation tools, but the conversation still happens between the attendees using the map as kind of, as a support for the conversation. Whereas in the digital space, you can have a conversation with the map. You can change the map as you go. You can say, you know what? Actually, I don't think this node is in the right place. It should probably be closer to here. Or what about connecting this and this together? What happens if we do that? And so in the same way that I've always loved taking notes because it allowed me to kind of make different authors across different books have a conversation together that they maybe never had because they were living across different centuries, I feel like the map is able to capture the conversation at different points and to morph and adapt as you go, as more information, connections, etc. emerge. So it's probably a more dynamic way to do it. And the same way as Lorenzo was saying, that we've been using this page as the metaphor by default so far. But by building this in a digital space, you can break free from this and you can make the map take any kind of shape and make sure that it helps you think rather than forcing you to think a certain way.
It's interesting because as you were talking, I was remembering that in graphic facilitation workshops, very often people will walk up with post-its and there'll be some exercise on the wall and everybody, and the way they get to interact visually is by writing something on it with a magic marker on a, or the Sharpie on a post-it and putting that someplace. And that thing is not an artifact they can then interact with later. And one of the things that's made me sad also is after the workshop, you will get snapshots, JPEGs or PDFs of the images that the graphic recorder created, which you're going to file away someplace because they're not a durable artifact in a shared space to prolong or improve the conversation. And the tools that I've seen that a lot of people like, you know, gather.app or whatever, there's a couple different online spaces where you're actually in a virtual space, but not so much in a document and you're not really sharing. The closest we've all come to this, and this is a pandemic thing as well, Zoom and Miro or Mural, right? And Zoom eventually built a whiteboard function into themselves during the pandemic. But Miro is the closest that people get to this. And it feels like Miro often degenerates into chaos because Miro seems to require really good information architects. Like somebody, a few people on deck, if it's going to be a multi-user Miro, a few people on deck need to be disciplined about how this, what the shape of the space is, and corralling in the strays and getting people who are doing dumb stuff to undo the dumb thing and so on and so forth. It takes a tremendous amount of sort of effort to do that. Lorenzo, have you learned a lot for Jen's notes from interactions in Miro during lockdown? And then how is that playing out for you?
Yeah, I'm still having a lot of interesting interviews about this topic. I would say brainstorming, UX research, affinity mapping, those kind of activity that normally happens at the whiteboard and normally, you know, take time and effort, as you were saying, right? You have to, especially the part where you actually have to make sense of this thing because, you know, brainstorming, yes, we generate idea, it's cool, it's also fun, but then you actually have to distill them down and take action on them. And sometimes you just leave the stuff there because, you know, it really takes time and effort. And so one of the really interesting thing that happens once you add artificial intelligence on top of these artifacts and tools is that actually part of the work can be outsourced to this tool. And so, for example, we can say cluster for me the things, which doesn't mean that you're going to be replaced. That's not the direction I want to go, definitely. Like the thing that I'm trying to do here is really like a hybrid approach that drives and helps you into certain direction, or at least to explore some path. But definitely, you know, at the end, I think we're still the owners. We are still the drivers, because I think that AI and humans ultimately solve different classes of problems, right? So AI is much better than us at finding relationship among a lot of stuff, a lot of information. Again, information overload, there is a lot of noise. How do I find the signal? But once you have found the actual signal, then we are much better than AI at, you know, find meanings and getting meaningful ideas to move the thing forward. So the magic happens when we combine the two together. And definitely brainstorming, UX research, any type of qualitative research are definitely great use cases that today happens on Miro, but could be improved.
How creative do you think AI is?
That's an interesting question.
It's a fun one.
Yeah. I think we have to think about what do you mean by creativity in the first place.
Good question. I mean, I'm sort of asking, what do you mean by creativity? And when you're interacting with the AI algorithms that you're busy using, do you think of them as creative? Or when you look at your plans for what to do with Gems Notes in the future, do you think about creativity from the side of the AI that's involved? And I feel like as I'm asking the question and refining it, I'm making it narrower. I don't want to do that. I want to keep it as broad as you'd like to take it.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I hope to not get into too philosophical stuff here. I don't know. I think that creativity in the end is like, I wouldn't say that AI is creative. It's creative itself. And that's the reason why I'm not sold to the vision of using AI, you know, to actually replace the process. That's
for the creative parts, right? There's lots of conversations about either cyborgs or centaurs. I don't know which one's going to win, or maybe some other term will win, but half human, half technology, a technology enhanced human. And because of my symbiotic relationship with the brain, I feel like I'm already well into this cyborg. And so it sounds like what you're trying to do is be really pragmatic about what AI can actually bring to the party now to free people up to do the creative work, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think also one of the things that I'm observing in with this large language models, OpenAI and all these things, for example, generative AI, right? So is that people are really using it to, using it to generate new ideas, images, DALL-E, all these things, right? Text, copywriting. And I think that's great, but I think it should be just the first part of the pipeline. Like, I think the could be like a good trigger for us, but we actually have to really take it as an inspiration, as a spark, and actually act on it as humans. Because what I'm seeing in the market is that sometimes we just take it as the end thing, right? The end-to-end process. So I have to write this thing and, you know, I click a button and great, I have it. And let's share it. And I'm not really encouraged by that kind of vision and future. Because what's going to happen is that pretty fast we'll have the internet basically made by AI, right? Like the vast majority of the content out there will actually be made up by AI. That to me, it doesn't sound like the place where the world that where you want to live, right?
It's not a world you desire. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really hope we use these tools and models that are actually way more powerful than just generating text, I think, in ways that actually help us to augment our own creative capacities instead of replacing them.
And Laura, is AI creative? Can it be?
I think AI is creative because I think that creativity is always combinational. So as long as you're combining two things or more and come up with something new, then it's creative. Is it good quality? Is it interesting? I don't think so at the moment, not necessarily. But this is a very subjective thing. You can walk in a museum and see a lot of things that are creative, and not everyone is going to agree as to what is worthy of being called art and what is not worthy of being called art, what is actually what is interesting, what is thought-provoking, what is lazy. Some people would look at a piece of art and say, that's lazy, I don't get it. But it's still new, and it is still a unique combination that someone has put together to create something. So it is creative. So I think AI is creative, but at the moment, and it is the case very often with creativity, that by collaborating, you do end up having a better output. So I think at the moment, AI on its own is not, the creative output is really not at a level where you can do without a human kind of like co-pilot to help it. I think in the future it is possible that we get there. And I also worry, same as Lorenzo, that obviously every time you have a new technology, you also have bad actors that can end up just using it not to be creative, but to spam the web with repetitive, lazy, farm content. But I also think that a lot of really good things are going to be created through this process as AI becomes better and as we become better co-pilots ourselves.
So there's two examples I point to that tell me that I'm seeing creativity from AI machine learning. One of them is AlphaZero, which is basically Google's DeepMind project, where they started with AlphaGo, which was a Go playing generative system, and beat the world's top Go player. Then they had trained that AlphaGo with a bunch of historic games of Go played by experts. Then they just gave AlphaZero, that's why it's called Zero, no training on human games. They just gave it the rules of Go. And because it's such a limited domain, there are black and white squares on 19 by 19 grid, and here's how you take territory. Because the rules are so constrained, it could play itself and got better than everything else, better than AlphaGo, better than anything else. And there's a really cool chart that shows you sort of its progression. And there's a place at which it sort of peaks above all the other lines, and there's the curve just goes up. And that curve to me is creativity. And because and maybe this is one of the things I'm realizing from the two examples I'll offer, partly because it was doing things that humans thought weren't practical or weren't customary or weren't sort of things you did in that situation. It was not constrained by tradition or custom or habit or whatever. And so Go scholars are studying those new moves and going, oh my gosh, these are ways of winning games, and rather than being freaked out and leaving the whole sport. Similar things happened in chess, where now we have all sorts of freestyle chess that's like combinations of teams of humans and software, and the game has just changed in really interesting ways. And the second thing is generative algorithms around texts can create, you could say, I need to write an article about this theme. Give me five different ways to talk about it. And I know that for me, I get into a rut and I tell stories the same way over and over and over. And if something could sit there and sort of boot me out of my rut, out of my little track, and say, here's three or four other compelling ways to say what you're trying to say, I would be thrilled. And that would feel combinatorially creative, maybe in the way you were just describing, Anne-Laure. And those things, everything I just described, is available today. There's no magic needed for that to show up. So that's what's got me really excited about the space of combining these different superpowers.
But you're actually the one who does the synthesis, right? You get the trigger. Use the AI to get the triggers.
I clearly don't want to lose the human in the loop, because then we're hosed. Like, yeah. Need to keep the human in the loop. And there's plenty of dysfunctional, there's plenty of good dystopian science fiction that posits that we're no longer necessary once the AIs take over. But I also think that human in the loop, and this is where freestyle chess gets really interesting, and also military things, where suddenly there's a really quick sensor fusion happening with really expanded connectivity, with really expanded machine intelligence. And then there's a human trying to win a battle. That's just that frontier is going to feed also what we learn here, partly because games, technology games are sometimes the leading edge of what we figure out. What would solve a problem that you're facing, Lorenzo, right now, if something were available or somebody were to solve some particular issue?
Yeah, great question. Well, again, I'm really committed to this. I think we live in a world, in a very noisy world, right? There is a lot of stuff going on all the time. And I think it's getting increasingly hard to find the signal, as I said in the beginning. So I'm really committed to do something about that, about helping people really get to the meaningful piece of knowledge they need to move their project or personal growth or whatever forward. And one of the possible obstacles, as I was saying before, is probably generative AI, right? Because the way we're using it right now is actually to create more noise instead of decreasing it, right? Because you're basically like boosting the process of putting stuff out there. One of the interesting thing, though, I think could be explored with the large language models is actually doing the opposite, like using those models to actually try to narrow down and reduce and synthesize knowledge. So instead of asking them, hey, generate for me this piece of content, say, hey, generate for me this summary or what this thing is talking about, or, work in those kind of direction with the prompts, which is totally possible. It's just, what I see on the market today is definitely more towards the creative, generative stuff, probably because of the name, I don't know.
Thank you. And partly what you're saying makes me think that the way you'd like to implement AI would help us overcome innumeracy, availability bias, meaning when we're sitting in front of a large data set or many streams of information, we just pay attention to what we saw most recently. It sticks in our heads. We sort of see our own neighborhood vividly, but we don't see the larger context. And systems like you're describing could in fact say, hey, you're really excited about this thing over here, but in fact, in the bigger picture, here's kind of what's going on. So I love that. And Laura, same sort of question for you for the field. Like, what do you wish would emerge?
I'm a teacher and a researcher. So selfishly, I would love to see more applications to help us learn better. And in particular, I'm interested in seeing how we can use even generative AI to create more adaptive experiences. It is kind of connected to what you just said, Lorenzo, but you know, this tool, for example, elicit.org, where you can look at research papers and it gives you a summary. I think taking things a little bit further, it would be amazing if you could take any kind of piece of content, of knowledge, and have AI adapt it, present it to you based on your current level of knowledge and skills, based on what you know, so you can understand it as quickly as possible. So for a research paper, if you have no scientific background, just giving you the very simple, explain me like I'm five type of summary. But if you're a scientist in the field, just getting into the nitty-gritty, etc. And I think this is going to be so helpful in general in the future, both for people who just want to teach themselves different topics, but also to better communicate information in a way that's more transparent, that people understand better on the internet. So I'm very excited about that.
Would both of you like to have a smart assistant that was watching everything you did and making suggestions and going and running and bringing things, or would that creep you out? I mean, are you, is that a thing you'd like to have or use?
I mean, I already have Google everywhere, so technically it's happening. It's just not that useful at the moment.
Yeah, but I mean, when I'm busy saving things and putting them in the brain or whatever, I would love to have an AI on the side that says, hey, Jerry, that looks like an author and her book. Would you like me to put her other five books in your mind map? And I'm like, yeah. And I don't use metadata or tags or anything like that in the brain, only because it takes time and effort. And I know that every additional step that it's going to take me to to do the work, it decreases the likelihood I'm going to try to do the work. So the AI could also say, hey, here are the tags that I think are relevant to what you're doing right now. Can I just drop this metadata in with the basic data? And I'd be like, thumbs up, let's go. So there's a bunch of ways in which work can be completed and made better. And then when you have a lot more metadata, the possibilities are endless at the other end as well.
I think that right now it's the kind of thing that feels a little bit strange to us because we're not really used to it, but that maybe in 10 years we'll look back and think, oh, I used to do all of these things manually. How weird, how much time I was wasting basically doing all of that logistical stuff when now I have an assistant doing it. So I do feel like I have kind of a natural resistance to it, but I don't think it's necessarily rational, and I don't think that it's going to be, you know, it's probably going to go the other way. We're probably all going to have such assistance in the future doing all of these things that are going to feel like very high friction if we have to do themselves again. If at some point our assistant doesn't work or something like that, we'll be like, oh wow, I have to create that calendar entry and I have to import that metadata myself now.
I remember reading somewhere long ago that Leibniz, the co-inventor of calculus and polymath, and probably corresponded with over 600 people during his sort of working life in that era. And I'm like, wow, I probably contact 600 people through all the different socials that I'm on, you know, in a week, actually. No problem. And we have instantaneous communication with, you know, you shrug and there's a message sent. Sort of instantaneous, sometimes thoughtless communication. And you know, Leibniz, when he was sitting down, was probably thinking for quite a while before sending a message off to one of his collaborators. Now we have machine learning that can be part of that conversation. So the contrast is very sharp for me in terms of where we are and what the possibilities are. And yet, there's plenty of bad actors, as you mentioned earlier on, Laura, in the field, and these power tools are available just as easily to them. So there's a whole other set of questions and probably podcast episodes around, hey, how do we do good, friendly AI, good AI, whatever else you want to call it. There's a bunch of efforts already on the ground to do this. Just we're nearing the end of our time together. And I just want to know, what other things matter for you in this general realm of maps and creativity? What avenues or possibilities are exciting to you in this space?
I think at the moment, there are lots of amazing tools that are doing a great job at creating a good solo player experience when it comes to thinking in maps. You've mentioned how Miro can become very chaotic very quickly. So I think when it comes to maps and creativity, this is really the next frontier. How do we make that experience as smooth and enjoyable and productive as possible so you can actually unleash your collective creativity? You did mention, actually, I just thought about that, how you needed some kind of like map moderators when you were using such shared whiteboards, but maybe an AI can do that in the future, actually, and moderate it for us. So we'll see what that looks like. But I think once we start having really, really good multiplayer map making experiences, then we'll really start seeing the impact that it can have on creativity.
Love that. Thank you. And totally, I want that big time. Lorenzo?
Yeah, and I totally agree. And I would say, you know, what I'm observing in the interviews and interaction with the users and any person involved in some way with this, I'll totally say that, you know, that's exactly the thing that has to happen, I think. That really sounds like the next logical and useful step for these things. Because I think part of the reason then, when you are by yourself, sometimes some stuff just makes sense because, you know, it's in your brain, right? But when it comes to other people and collaborators, then that's where the thing starts breaking. And so, you know, having an AI or some sort of help that helps you actually recollect and recompose the whole thing and see the big picture, that will be very helpful as well.
Exactly. And I'm not hearing of AI research, and maybe I haven't been looking for it, that's doing this particular thing we just talked about, basically the stewarding or shepherding or coaching of humans trying to make sense together and figuring out, you know, how to maintain consistency of the space that they're working in some way, things like that. I'm not hearing this yet as a research topic. So I'm now sort of going to look for it and see what happens. Any other concluding thoughts? Anything else you'd like to add to the conversation?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up on this. I think we still are at a stage where we have to actually figure out first the design that actually unlocks our interaction with the AI, as I was saying before actually at the personal level, before actually moving to the collective one. Because I think that really from a design perspective, the thing we have, the metaphors we have today with the, you know, interfaces and stuff like that are kind of broken to actually take advantage of these new powerful tools we have. So we'll get there eventually, of course.
I think so too. I think so too. And Laura, anything you'd like to add?
I agree with Lorenzo. It's very early, but it is exciting. It's also really great that a lot of different actors from all sizes are working on this. We have some of the biggest tech companies working on this, but also I've seen really good tools built by solo founders. So I think this diversity of thought, actually, this is a bit meta, is really good for the field. And yeah, I'm very excited to see what's coming next.
Just the availability of power tools for small groups and individuals is astonishing. The code bases, the availability of large data sets, there's a whole bunch of technology available now that was hard to get to or not invented yet just a decade ago. And it's on the table right now, and it's really exciting with where we're going. Thank you for listening to Tools for Thinking, a new podcast that might just help you with your thinking. If you're part of a startup in this sector, please knock on our door at betaworks.com.